This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. NPR Morning Edition host and fellow Hoosier Steve Inskeep was back home this weekend speaking in Indianapolis. We got a chance to talk with him about the event he was invited to and a little about the current political climate and his experience growing up in central Indiana. This conversation was recorded on Thursday of last week.
Steve Inskeep, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, glad to do it.
Over the weekend, you'll give the keynote address at the Richard G. Lugar Symposium for Tomorrow's Leaders at the University of Indianapolis. Can you tell us about what this event is and who you'll be talking to there?
I will be talking with high school juniors from around the state of Indiana at what has been an annual event for many, many years. I'll be frank that I wasn't too familiar with this until I was asked effectively to stand in for the senator, which is a humbling thing to say. I don't feel I deserve it at all, but I'm going to give it a try. But after I began talking about this, and particularly after I mentioned it on Twitter, I began hearing from alumni of this event. And as some people listening will know, for many years, Senator Lugar at an annual gathering would host high school students from around the state. There would be a keynote address by the senator, and then they would break into smaller sessions and discuss important global affairs, which, of course, is something that Senator Lugar himself was deeply involved in. And it's clear to me from some of the responses that I've heard that people were inspired by this, inspired just by a moment that they got to shake his hand or something that he said or something that they heard in one of the sessions. And so I'm really excited to be part of this.
Yeah. How did you get involved? Who were you asked by?
The University of Indianapolis, which puts this on, asked if I could help out, and I was, you can't say no to a request like that, particularly because the university has been very kind to me over the years, and I'm happy to get back there again.
Do you know why they thought of you particularly for this? It sounds like you have a relationship with them.
Well, I'd been there a couple of times to speak. I'm reluctant to say why I would think that they would have thought of me. I suppose because, if there's any good reason at all, it would be that I am in a job that calls on me to think about the world, understand the world, and travel through a good part of the world. I've had an opportunity over the past 20 years or so to travel to several continents, to cover a number of wars, to see a lot of societies at times of dramatic change, and also to travel across an awful lot of the United States and see a lot of dramatic events. It's really been an education for me. And that's one of the things that I hope to discuss with the students over the weekend, is that I grew up in central Indiana. It was an amazing place to grow up, but I don't know that I had the widest lens, the widest view of the world. But I was able to use it as a starting point and able to grow out from there and able to go to Colombia and then to places like Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iran and parts of North Africa and China and other places as well. That I had that opportunity to do that is maybe something that we can discuss with the high school juniors over the weekend. I think that it's also an opportunity to talk about the importance of this moment in our history and the importance of America in the world, the enormous influence this country has had on different parts of the world, which you feel when you go abroad. Not everybody likes what America does. In fact, an awful lot of people have a lot of objections to what America does. And yet people are attracted to the idea of America and the idea of freedom here. And you will very often go to a place that has somewhat or very hostile relations with the United States. And one of the questions you get from ordinary people when you start chatting with them is, how can I get a visa to the United States? Or do you mind if I tell you my story of trying to get a visa to the United States? People are curious about America, even as they're critical of America, and they understand that the United States has an enormous influence on their lives almost anywhere they are in the world.
How have you seen those attitudes change in your reporting, if it's changed?
Well, let's think about that. I don't know that it has changed all that dramatically. It goes up, it goes down. There are periods where the United States is making dramatic moves that lots of people disagree with. If you think about the war in Iraq, which I covered on a number of occasions over the years, that was a deeply unpopular war that was opposed by people around the globe for a variety of reasons. And whatever we think of it, the rightness or wrongness of it, it was very, very unpopular around the world. But if we back up just a couple of years before that, when the United States was attacked on September 11, 2001, there was global sympathy for the United States and global support for the United States. And we should remember that in that moment, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, essentially the United States' European allies, along with Canada, NATO immediately came to our aid and our defense. And there were troops who fought alongside American troops in Afghanistan in the war that followed 9/11. There have been other turns of fate. The United States recovered its standing in the world somewhat under President Obama. And this is not a statement for or against President Obama, but it is a fact in terms of surveys that people had a more positive view of the United States in Obama's time because, at least partly, of the policies that he pursued, or perhaps the way that he pursued them, or the kind of person that he was. The United States has lost a lot of popularity under President Trump, and I don't think that that should be seen as any great surprise. Again, that's not a positive or negative statement about President Trump. He actually campaigned on getting tougher with other countries in many ways and doing things that they would not necessarily like. So there's certainly nothing to be surprised about there.
Yeah, and a lot of people talk about the effect President Trump has had specifically on how people around the world see America. Have you seen that impact when you talk to people?
Well, let's think about that. Yes. The last two countries that I have visited in the last 7-8 months are Iran and China. Those are two countries with which the United States is in the midst of dramatic confrontations. Now, we should remember that in each case, the confrontation goes way back before President Trump. And so in each case, it's the Trump administration chapter of that confrontation. The United States, since the 1970s, has been trying to engage China, trade with China, bring China into the world marketplace, into the rules-based world marketplace, with, as Americans in both parties would now generally agree, with deeply mixed results. Enormous economic growth for China, a lot of economic benefit for the United States, but China does not play by the same rules as the rest of the world, and the United States has been very frustrated in its efforts to get China to do so. And the latest of many efforts by multiple administrations to bring China to a different way of doing business is the trade war that's been launched by President Trump, which has not yet met its goal. And we don't know if it's going to meet its goal or partly meet its goal or completely fail. We'll just have to keep covering that and find out what happens. But when you travel to China, you run into a lot of corporate executives who are thinking about their relationship with the United States. And, of course, these are executives who also have a relationship with the government of China. It's a kind of state-directed capitalism where there are large companies that act independently when they can, but the government is there and is ever present, and an immense force in a way that it would not necessarily be in the United States. And so you see people rethinking those business relationships. You also see ordinary Chinese people who have to think a little bit about their engagement with the United States. There are hundreds of thousands, surely many millions of Chinese citizens who have studied over the years in American universities, which has been an enormous benefit to China and is also an enormous extension of American power. You have all of these people coming out of an unfree society and experiencing our free society and gaining whatever benefit they can and going back again. And now some Chinese students have to rethink those relationships because the overall, or have to rethink that course of study because the overall relationship is getting worse. It's getting a little bit harder to get visas. People are viewed a little more as spies when they come to the United States. And maybe the education is seen as a little bit less valuable when they go back to China. So that's become more complicated for them as well. And yet I want to mention one other thing to you, Matt, just about China. We can talk about Iran, too. When we wanted to sample public opinion in China, we picked a small city, and by small, I mean only a million or so outside of Beijing. We picked a city called Langfang, and we went there by train, and we went out on the streets and just at random interviewed a number of people. and ask them for a word that comes to mind when they think of the United States. And the first two words that anybody told us were democracy and freedom. And people gave other words like progress, technology, openness. They had, on the whole, very positive views of the United States. And it was instant. When you asked them to just grab a word, that was the word that came to mind. And that tells me that in spite of the tensions of this moment, and it may be a very long moment, we really don't know, there is this residual interest in, this even residual admiration for the United States, even inside this country whose leaders would like to position it as really one of the next leaders of the world, and who confidently expect China to have a larger economy than the United States one day.
Now, getting back to the event that you'll speak at in Indiana, how do you talk to young people about these sort of big, complicated issues like this? Do you change how you talk in any way?
Oh, my goodness. I wouldn't pretend to be an expert in that. I'm just going to try to pay attention to people and listen to them a little bit as well as speak. I'm glad that there is a question and answer period. I want to listen to people. I want to learn. You learn a lot more listening than you do talking. But with that said, I hope that I'm able to relate to people who are a good deal younger than me, just because I came from where they came from, because I came from Central Indiana, because I was a high school student at Carmel High School, because I've shared some of their experiences. I think also when you talk to young people, if you're, up around 50, which I am, 51, when you turn your attention to young people, I think you have to do it with a great deal of respect for their knowledge. It's my impression, now that I'm a parent, and spend time around teenagers or even kids younger than teenagers, I continually think they are a lot better informed about things than I was at that phase of my life. They've got the internet, which I didn't have when I was a kid. Computers were just spreading then. They have access to immense amounts of information. They can learn that information instantly. They are in the same situation that we as grown-ups are, that really it's the problem is we have too much information and we have to sort it and make sense of it and figure which of it to believe and which is not worth believing. But they can be enormously sophisticated and enormously informed.
Up next, more of my conversation with Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our pre-recorded conversation with NPR Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep.
Indiana Senator Richard Lugar died earlier this year. You made some comments about him on Twitter about the kind of politician he was, and he was the man who used to give this address. What did you find interesting about him?
Well, growing up, I admired him, and I think I was about to say everybody did. There must have been somebody in Indiana who didn't. I mean, not everybody voted for him. Only, 65, 70, 75% of the people would vote for him, but he would win in landslides. And I want to try to put it simply. I think that, when you're a kid, you don't know everything that Richard Lugar got involved in, particularly because he got involved in complex issues that were not hot-button issues. He was Republican, he was conservative, but he wasn't really prominent on the hot-button issues that divide the parties. He was thinking about nuclear proliferation. He was thinking about securing the nuclear weapons of the former Soviet Union. He was thinking about the United States' place in the world and a variety of complicated foreign policy problems. He also, for a while, was the chair of the Agriculture Committee, which, of course, is directly relevant to the lives of an awful lot of Hoosiers. But still, if you're not involved in ag policy, if you're not a farmer, maybe even if you are a farmer, you don't necessarily closely follow the ins and outs of that. But what I think that we were aware of growing up was that Senator Lugar was a guy from Indiana who was prominent on the national stage, who was respected, who was admired, who was listened to by presidents of both parties. He had a particularly remarkable quality in that I don't recall ever hearing him raise his voice. In fact, he would speak so quietly that it would almost seem to be a mumble sometimes. But people would listen for that quiet voice because they found wisdom in it. And people who were not even of his party would seek his advice. And that was something we were really proud of. Now, years later, when I became a reporter, one of the first things I was assigned to do in 1996 was cover the New Hampshire presidential primary, and one of the presidential candidates was Richard Lugar. He was running for president in that year. Bill Clinton was the Democrat who was seeking re-election, and there was a variety of Republicans. And I recall, I don't have it hand, but I recall reading newspaper articles that flatly described Lugar as the guy who was probably the most qualified to be president, but who was very unlikely ever to be president, because he didn't have a big narrative. He wasn't putting on a big show, but he was respected for knowing what he was talking about, and that made us proud. I think that's a big reason that he won such big landslides.
Yeah, we can't talk about Richard Lugar in 2019 and not talk about political rhetoric either, which has certainly changed since the 2016 election. A lot of people talk about how things are more polarized than ever, and you can hear a sense of nostalgia with some for the good old days when politicians were more respectful. How did Lugar fit into that?
Well, let's think about some parts of his career. First, the way that his political career or his career in elective office ended. He lost a primary battle in 2012. One of the things that he did as a conservative Republican that angered what we would call his political base was cooperate with President Obama. He gave him advice. Obama, I think, was said to find Lugar to be his favorite Republican senator. And I think that Lugar, I never had an in-depth discussion with him about it, but I think that Lugar would have seen that as acting for the good of the country. It's not that he agreed with everything that Obama did, not that he agreed with most of what Obama did even, but that he thought that there were certain issues, particularly on foreign policy, where we have one president at a time and Lugar had good advice and he was going to give the good advice and he was going to give the help when he could give the help. And that frustrated some people, and he was painted as being soft on Obama in this very divisive time. He also got in trouble for allegedly being out of touch. Some people who were around in that election will recall that he had lost his voting address, his official voting address. He didn't live there anymore, and he had some difficulty establishing a proper residence within Indiana. He owned a farm. He was connected to Indiana, but as his longtime senator, he spent a lot of time in Washington. So when we talk about divisive times, Richard Lugar in the end was a casualty of those divisive times. There was a time when lawmakers in both parties collaborated a little more easily than they do now. I don't want to pretend that there actually were good old days, though. There were phenomenally divisive times in this country. Richard Lugar became mayor of Indianapolis, and you'll check my facts here, but I believe it was the late 1960s when Lugar became mayor of Indianapolis. A phenomenally divisive time, a time of tremendous social convulsion, a time of political violence, a time of nonviolent protest in the civil rights movement that often was responded to with police violence, a time of assassinations. And some people will recall that when Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 1968, that Robert F. Kennedy, who was then running for president, was campaigning in Indianapolis. And the mayor at that time was Richard Lugar. It was a phenomenally divisive time. Kennedy went out into the streets of Indianapolis and gave a speech and spoke movingly in a tape and video that many people will have seen and heard, spoke movingly about losing someone close to you through a killing like that. And Lugar was a mayor in that time. That was a phenomenally divisive time. That was a time of great divisions between races, great divisions between classes, divisions between different ideas of the world and different ideas of America. And there was a widespread perception that the country in some way was breaking down, that the institutions were falling apart. So I'm not even sure that this divisive time is nearly so bad as that divisive time was, but it was divisive in a different way, and you did still have bipartisan action, bipartisan coalitions who would get together and get things done. You would have Republicans and Democrats joining together to pass civil rights legislation in the 1960s, to give one example. You would have Republicans and Democrats in 1974 deciding that President Richard Nixon, who'd been under investigation and facing impeachment, that he simply had to go. And it was because Republicans turned against their own party's president that he, in fact, did have to go. You had agreement on environmental legislation in that time. You had widespread agreement on vital issues that cut across party lines. And it's different now. And I'm not sure that people's views are all that different, but we view everything through a partisan lens a lot more often.
How have you seen politicians change how they talk to the media and use the media throughout your career?
Well, I want to mention something that I realized some years ago in the early 2000s. I had an opportunity in the early 2000s to listen to some archival tape of George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, who was president from 1989 to 1993. And George W. Bush, of course, was president when I'm listening to this archival tape of his father. And what was striking in this old news conference of George H.W. Bush was the extremely sophisticated language that he used. Just the large vocabulary, the long sentences, the sophisticated ideas, he laid it out there. And George H.W. Bush in his time wasn't even considered the most articulate guy. He would often trip over the soundbite. But the complicated ideas he would actually get across really well. And he did not speak down to the people. And I think that in more recent years, we've seen just more short sentences, more short assertions. People don't necessarily do as good a job, and I'm just evaluating here, do as good a job of making an argument. They make assertions. That is different. You say that someone is bad. You don't necessarily take anyone through the facts to say why. You throw a bunch of dark-sounding conspiracy out there, but you don't connect it all up in any way that it makes any sense. And one of the most profound things that happens, it always happens, but I think it happens more and it is worse, is the act of labeling. In fact, if anybody listening to me wants to take anything, one thing away from this discussion, I hope it's an awareness of what political labeling is and what it means and why it works so that you can be aware of it. Labeling is saying, if you're a Republican, say, don't listen to anything that person has to say because they're a Democrat. Or if the reverse is true, of course, you know, if you're a Democrat talking to fellow Democrats, don't listen to that person over there. All you need to know about him is that he's a Republican. All you need to know about her is that she is conservative. You are told to look at the label. You were told that the person is biased, and therefore you should not pay any attention to any argument that they have. This is the way the media is attacked. You know, don't believe what's in the New York Times because it is the New York Times. Don't believe what's, you know, any media organization you want to name. And this labeling is urging you, ordering you not to think, not to reason, not to gather information, not to weigh that information, just to shut your mind. That's what that labeling does. It's a very common political technique. It didn't start with the current president. It didn't start with this current Congress. It's always been around. It is a way of arguing that is not actually arguing. It's telling you not to argue, just to believe the person that you're listening to. And I think it's gotten worse. And I think that it's necessary for people to be aware when it happens and to know that the person who tells you not to listen to someone is insulting you, is insulting your intelligence and trying to get you not to think.
So can we look at this through sort of a physics lens? Could this wave ebb back? You said it's getting worse, but do you feel like in your experience, which is a lot more than mine, that politically we could end up heading back to a more civil time?
Oh, sure. I mean, let's keep it in perspective. It's democracy. Democracy is always rambunctious. Democracy is about division and conflict. If we had a perfectly unified society, I think we'd all be terrified to live in it. And in fact, that conflict can be good if it's a competition of ideas and the best idea comes out. But yeah, things can get better. And I don't just say that because I'm basically an optimist, but also because, well, I'm a historian. I've written books of history anyway. And you learn to take the long view of things. And you learn that a lot of problems that we face now are problems that we've faced before. And a lot of the rhetoric that we face now, there have been similar versions of that in the past. And it comes and it goes.
All right, let's bring it home, literally. You were raised in Carmel, Indiana. What was it like growing up in Indiana for you?
Oh, well, it was a fantastic place to grow up, where I learned so much. My parents, Roland and Judith Inskeep, were both teachers. My dad also was a coach and became the athletic director at North Central High School. And my mom taught a number of places, including Carmel Junior High School. And it was a wonderful community. Carmel in those days was what we would call a bedroom community. There's a lot of houses, a lot of neighborhoods, suburban, north side of Indianapolis, of course. And it has changed enormously. It's changed so much that I get a little disoriented when I go home now, because there's a lot of office towers and there's all those roundabouts and there's a giant performing arts center and there's restaurants everywhere and delis and just really interesting architecture and things going on. Completely different place, but it still has something really essential that I benefited from growing up, which was a great school system. And I say this knowing that somebody listening really resents Carmel because they keep winning state football championships. And I'll try not to mention too loudly that my brother Jim is the athletic director at Carmel High School, and the coaches who work for him and with him have won so many state titles. I get that people resent that. But, of course, if you're growing up in that school system, the thing that you really get, that you really benefit from, is a good education. And it's great to be in a community where people are really proud of the school, a community where people have in the past voted tax increases on themselves to pay for the improvement of the school. And it's a great school and a great school system. And we learned a lot there. And I was prepared to go out into the world, even though I didn't have a really good understanding of what the world was or what was out there for me.
There's a common criticism that you hear levied at major media outlets, especially concerning political news coverage, that the middle of the country, where we are, is often ignored. And when it is covered, it's often seen as a coastal reporter flying in, talking to a few people, and then flying back to write what can be a pretty surface-level look at a really complicated population. I'm curious, since you grew up here and you now work for a national outlet on the East Coast, what are your thoughts on that?
First, I think that criticism is fair. I think it's maybe even a little worse. It's not even that someone from the coast comes in to have a quick look around. It's that nobody shows up at all. Or if they do, they cover some spectacular crime, some horrifying murder, someone who shows terrible human depravity, which is compelling. And it sells, but doesn't really tell you about the community necessarily, does it? There's so many things happening in this country, and they're not necessarily well covered nationally or even necessarily well covered locally, because local newspapers have lost so much of their reporting staffs, or in some cases gone out of business entirely. They're just not what they were. And important social trends are not being covered. And governments are not really being covered, and governmental corruption is not being investigated the way that it could be. And there's so many things going on that aren't covered the right way or just not covered at all. I'm less worried really about East Coast elitism or West Coast elitism than I am about nobody even showing up. And that's a problem. Now, I do want to brag a little bit and say two things about public broadcasting. First, I know, having begun my career in local public radio stations, that in city after city after city, local public radio stations are a lot stronger than they used to be. I was just in the hallway minutes before this interview talking with an NPR colleague who is familiar with WFYI and began naming off impressive reporters who are on the staff of WFYI. I won't embarrass them by naming them here, but really good people who were at FYI who weren't there a few years ago. And there are a lot of stations that used to have 3 news reporters and now they have 30. There's been a big expansion. Public media has stepped into at least some of the void that's been left by the decline of local newspapers. I would argue also that my colleagues here on the national level at NPR use those resources from local stations and also use brilliant national correspondents to cover the middle of the country. And you hear the middle of the country in the accents of the middle of the country. You turn on the radio and you hear Debbie Elliott from Alabama, or John Burnett from Texas, or Cheryl Corley from Chicago. And I could go on at quite some length. Any number of people who are living in, as you said, the middle of the country, living away from the coasts, have an experience away from the coasts, have a sense of the depth of, and complexity of the stories that there are to tell in different places, and they're bringing those stories home, and we give them some time, we give them real time on the air to tell those stories, and we also cover them over time, because you really don't get a full picture from a quick trip to a state that you've never been to. It might be that you only have a quick trip, but you should go back later and go back again and go back again, because it's, you know, it's like a novel. It's like a story. You don't want to just read one page. You want to get the whole thing. And so I think we are trying really hard to pay attention to the middle of the country in a way that other people just don't.
He's giving the keynote address at the Richard G. Lugar Symposium for Tomorrow's Leaders at the University of Indianapolis. And if you're listening to this, you know his voice anyway, the host of Morning Edition, Steve Inske. Thank you so much for your time.
Glad to do it.
Up next, Atlas Obscura co-founder Joshua Foer on the Indiana destinations that made the Travel Guide's new print edition. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Many travelers are familiar with Atlas Obscura, a website devoted to the interesting destinations that are a little off the beaten path, always figuratively, often literally. There are almost 100 Indiana destinations listed on their website, but 3 of them have made the cut for Atlas Obscura's second edition print version. The new book is out now, and here to talk with us is co-founder and chairman of Atlas Obscura, Joshua Foer. Joshua, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I think I first heard about Atlas Obscura on NPR, and our show, of course, airs on NPR member stations in Indiana. When I first heard about it, I thought, what a brilliant idea. I'm not a tourist trap kind of person. I don't want to go where everyone else is going. I want to experience the unique and strange places that you can only see in that one place, wherever I happen to be. Is that how it started for you, too? Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I mean, so when I was about 20 years old, I bought an old beat-up minivan and spent the summer driving all over the United States trying to find just the most extraordinary hidden corners of this country. That's when I fell in love with travel. It's when I fell in love with America as a place to spend a lot of time digging deep. And it's probably where Atlas Obscura came from, in that there was no great resource for somebody like me who was out trying to find, you know, really amazing hidden stuff. And that's part of the reason we created Atlas Obscura.
And the website has thousands of destinations around the world. How did you narrow down what to include in the first and now the second edition of the book?
Yeah, so, you know, the heart of this enterprise is a online database where people all over the world share tips about the world's most extraordinary hidden wonders. And we've now got close to 20,000 of those places online. And of course, you can't fit 20,000 places into a book, but we've made a real doorstop of a book. I mean, it's 500 plus pages, lots of color photos, almost 1,000 entries in it. And we had to be very judicious in picking the very, very best places all over the world on all 7 continents. The goal being, we want it so that when you open this book to any page, you find something that absolutely surprises you and makes you say, oh my goodness, I cannot believe this shares planet Earth with me right now. And we also want for you to open to the page of the book where you live and to find something that hopefully you didn't know about. So, you know, if we've done that, then we've succeeded.
And of course, it does cover the best destinations on the planet, not just the U.S., and so you had to be selective. I'm glad that Indiana made the cut at all. Do you remember what made you choose the 3 Indiana destinations?
Just 3 wild and cool places that I think are not widely known. I don't know how widely known they are in Indiana. They're certainly not widely known outside of Indiana. One of them that I've never been to, although I met the man behind this, is the Slocum Mechanical Puzzle Collection in Bloomington, which is the world's greatest, as far as I'm aware, greatest collection of mechanical puzzles. And they're all held in the university library, and you can go visit them. I think you can even check them out. And it's everything from, you know, Rubik's, like, you know, the original Rubik's cubes to mental, the physical dexterity puzzle, things that, you know, you have to pull apart or put back together. I love those kinds of puzzles, and I love the idea that there is this great library of them. It's got something like 40,000 puzzles, and it's, you know, it's just like a wonderful collection that you wouldn't necessarily know about. And now that you know about it, hopefully you're interested in visiting it and maybe even checking one of the puzzles out.
Yeah, Jerry Slocum was just he was a real puzzle nut. And like you said, 40,000 puzzles, and he donated them to the Lilly Library. And what are some of the more interesting puzzles on display there?
So they've got a Rubik's Cube for the blind, I believe, which has different kinds of nails on it. So you can solve the Rubik's Cube on each side with different textures, so a blind person can solve the Rubik's Cube. There are wooden puzzles, metal puzzles, geometrical curiosities that, you know, you twist and shift and take apart and put back together. And there are also historic puzzles because, you know, puzzle making is a very old pastime. And so I believe Jerry has been a collector for a long time and had assembled one of the world's great collections. And it's very cool that it exists, you know, in Bloomington.
Yeah. And when you go there, can you touch them and try to solve them, or can you just look at them? It seems like that'd be kind of a waste if you could just look at them.
My understanding, and I actually haven't been myself, my understanding is you can try out a number of the puzzles. Some of them are on display, but some of them are actually there available for you to solve.
And not just the 30,000 mechanical puzzles. He also collected thousands of books, many of which are at the Lilly Library collection as well. And you can see it there at the IU campus. And I mean, back to what you said earlier about, you know, had we heard of it? I'm sure that some of our listeners had heard of the three entries in the book. But I hadn't heard of two of them. And one of them was the Slocum Puzzle Collection. The other one was a curious one that started with a game of catch gone wrong. Can you tell us about the world's largest ball of paint?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the surprising things about assembling a database of, you know, 20,000 wondrous and curious things around the world is you start to see themes. And there is a theme that one finds played out all over the world, but especially, I would say, in the American Midwest, of people making gigantic balls of stuff. So there are people who, there have been competitions to, you know, wind the largest ball of twine. And by the way, that is a, there are two towns in the Midwest that claim to have the largest ball of twine. And Indiana, to its, I'm sure, enormous pride and honor, is the home of a 4,000-pound ball of paint that was started, I think, in the 1970s. And it's just, it started with a baseball, and a guy sort of started painting that baseball and then painting more layers on the baseball. And they've now painted the baseball 25,000 times. This guy, his wife, their children, their grandchildren, he invites visitors to come and add layers of paint. The ball is now 14 feet in circumference. And, you know, you can visit it in Alexandria, Indiana. And, it's a tribute to persistence and to, just trying to do something a little bit different. I love that. And somebody who just decided I'm going to do something a little weird with my life. And in a way, when you encounter something like that, it can be, you might look at it and say, well, like, what's the point? Well, of course, what's the point? But it's also kind of inspiring in a way.
Can I go paint it?
My understanding is that you can. Yeah. If you call ahead and schedule an appointment, you can contribute a layer of paint.
Well, that's brilliant, because then that takes the work off of them, although I'm sure they still do a good bit of the work. Let's go to Crawfordsville now. I used to live in Crawfordsville, and this place always intrigued me. What is special about the Rotary Jail?
So in the latter part of the 19th century, there was a new innovation a new solution to the architectural problem of how to contain prisoners. And it was invented in Indiana by a pair of architects. And it was a jail that rotated. And the idea was, if you could have, like central plumbing running through a pipe in the middle of this jail, you could then effectively create a round jail that could spin like a carousel and would have one point of access, right? You could not get out unless the jail was spun in such a way that, you know, an individual cell aligned with the door, which made it virtually impossible to escape from. And the first one was built in Crawfordsville. It was widely hailed at the time. And actually, other rotary jails were built in Iowa. I think one was built in Missouri. Something like 18 of them were built across the Midwest at the end of the 19th century. There was a problem here, which was that as the jail rotated, it had a terrible habit of crushing the hands and limbs of prisoners. Subsequently went out of service sometime in the 1930s. But you can still visit it. And that's, you know, like a wonderfully strange corner of architectural history, of prison history in America. And it's a credit to Indiana that it's been preserved.
Yeah, like you said, about maybe a dozen and a half of these were built mostly in the Midwest. Three of them still survive as museums, one in Gallatin, Missouri, one in Council Bluffs, Iowa. And in Iowa, they called that one the Squirrel Cage Jail, which I thought was kind of funny. But there is something special that sets the Crawfordsville Jail apart as a museum.
That this is the one that still spins.
And that's pretty incredible. I mean, what I can't believe is that despite the mechanical troubles and the safety issues, just how long this jail and these jails operated. They opened, the one in Crawfordsville opened in the 1880s. Didn't close until the early 70s. And I mean, also the dehumanization of not only being in a jail, but being in a jail that was, as they said in Iowa, like a squirrel cage.
Yeah, it's spinning around you. I mean, you know, I would say one of the themes in this book, and there are certainly many themes that if you read the whole book cover to cover, all 500 pages, you'll discover that there are certain things that fascinate us particularly. And one of them is beautifully bad ideas from the past that somehow managed to get built or and have survived. I'm just thinking of another one right now in England, which is the Tempest Prognosticator, which was a machine for predicting the weather using the behavior of saltwater leeches, or freshwater leeches, excuse me. They would get uppity when a storm was approaching, and so this crazy, you know, British inventor attached bells to these leeches, put them in, speaking of carousels, a kind of round machine, and thought that he had invented a new way to predict the weather. And I just, like, what a crazy, terrible, but also sort of beautifully strange and almost Borgesian idea. And you can still find a working, I mean, it's not really working, but, you know, a live version of this sort of, I guess you'd call it a barometer, in a museum, a tiny little museum in England called the Barometer World Museum, which, you know, I love that. There's like a museum dedicated to barometers in England. And another one of the themes running through this book and through the website is we love small museums, small collections, collections of unusual things like, well, like mechanical puzzles.
Okay, so that brings me to a really generic question. Of the thousands and thousands of entries on the website and the hundreds in this book, are any of them ones that you just absolutely had to see as soon as you found out about them and then eventually did?
Okay, so there's one that was submitted very early on. We've been at this for now about 10 years. It was submitted, I think, in the first year. And me and my co-founder, Dylan, when we heard about it, we said, that can't really be true. At the time, there was very little on the internet about this place. Now there's a lot. You can find it all over the place on the internet. It's called the Gates of Hell, and it's in Turkmenistan. And if you see a photograph of it, and I would encourage your listeners to go Google this, it almost looks like a volcano erupting out of the desert. And it was the result of an industrial mining accident in the 1970s. Where some Soviet geologists accidentally drilled into a pocket of natural gas. The gas started escaping, they said, let's set it on fire. It'll all burn off in a couple days. This fire has been going for 40-plus years now. And Dylan and I said, you know, one day we should really, like, if this Atlas Obscura thing works, we should go to the gates of hell and have a beer together. And lo, this spring, Dylan and I are going to be finally going to the gates of hell. We're going to bring 12 Atlas Obscura readers with us to go finally have that beer at the edge of the gates of hell. So I'm looking forward to crossing that one off of my lifelong bucket list.
Okay, so that's one that you like but have not yet been to yet. What about one that that you have put on your list that you've actually gotten to visit and were either impressed by, it was more than you had imagined it would be, or maybe one that was a little underwhelming?
So Dylan and I spent 5 weeks traveling all over South America trying to, first of all, to visit some of the places that people had submitted to Atlas Obscura that we just didn't really have enough information about, but also to see if we could find some places that belonged in Atlas Obscura that hadn't been contributed by anybody yet. And one of the really special places we visited was a place called the Quechua Chaca in Peru, several hours outside of Cusco. And the Quechua Chaca is the last standing Incan grass suspension bridge. So during Incan times, they had to cross these, you know, obviously enormous valleys in the Andes, and they built bridges out of grass. They would weave grass together and build suspension bridges. And these were bigger bridges than anything that existed in Europe. Europe didn't invent suspension bridges until 500 years after the fall of the Incan Empire. And all of those bridges have ceased to exist except for one. And Dylan and I found the last Incan grass rope bridge. We met the man who is in charge of its maintenance and actually crossed this bridge over a high river valley, which was, you know, a little bit perilous and quite scary. And that for me was one of the really great experiences I've had in the process of you know, helping bring Atlas Obscura into the world.
In the last minute or minute and a half that we have, I just wanted to ask this. I'm kind of surprised at the choices when it comes to the three entries in Indiana, because they're kind of out of the way. I mean, Bloomington's a destination. There's a lot to see in Bloomington in addition to the Slocum Mechanical Puzzle Collection. But beyond a couple popular state parks near Crawfordsville, it's not really a tourism destination. And forget Alexandria, where the Ball of Pain is. The closest major cities are Muncie and Anderson, which don't get a lot of tourism traffic, to put it lightly. What was that a factor, or maybe an anti-factor, when it came to choosing these places or other places in the book collection?
So I would say there are kind of two answers to that. The first is, we very strongly believe that you don't have to travel halfway around the world to experience a sense of wonder, that you can find it in your own backyard if you're willing to look for it, if you know how to look for it, and we want Atlas Obscura to be a guide to help you find it. The other answer is, all over the world, we try and point people not to, you know, the places where everybody is already going. There are a lot of people on this planet, and if they're all visiting the Louvre, it doesn't really work. And so it's important if you know, to get outside of the main tourist cities and to see places that are not as well trodden. And one of the things that we found over the years of doing this is how grateful the proprietors of places that we featured in Atlas Obscura have been. They say, look, like, we wouldn't be able to continue to exist if we hadn't been put on the map by Atlas Obscura. And you've brought people to us, and you know, and that's allowed us to continue to exist. And one of our fears was that we would make hidden places sort of, they'd sell out when they were on Atlas Obscura. They'd become too popular. Too many people would visit them. And what we've observed is that that's not what happens. The places disappear because they're underloved more than they disappear because they're overloved. And so we're proud to have helped shine some light on some places that otherwise might have disappeared.
Joshua Ford, he's the co-founder of Atlas Obscura, and he's one of the authors of the second edition of the Atlas Obscura print edition, which is out now. Joshua, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts. And tomorrow we'll talk about how Indiana schools are dealing with vaping. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.